astonished to realise that it's been 17 years since the campaign led by Eddie Mabo for Indigenous land rights resulted in the historic High Court of Australia ruling overturning the legal statute of terra nullius. But it's been 164 years since John Batman, one of the founding fathers of Melbourne, offered treaties and trinkets to the traditional owners of the lands around the Yarra, the only treaties that have been offered to Australian Aboriginal people and rejected a year later by the colonial authorities. How significant were these treaties, and did they have any impact on the long road to native title? Now, I'm joined by Bain Attwood. Bain's Professor of Historical Studies at Monash, Adjunct Professor at the Centre for Cross-Cultural Research at the ANU. He's been on the program a few times, 2005 being the last, when we talked about telling the truth about Aboriginal history. This time we're talking about his new book, Possession, Batman's Treaty and the Matter of History. And Bain joined us on the blubber from Melbourne, which, of course, could have been known as Batmania. Welcome back, Bain.
Thanks very much, Philip.
First off, refresh our minds about this paradoxical creature, John Batman.
Yes, well, he is often said to be responsible for a treaty between a group of settlers from Tasmania or Van Diemen's Land called the Port Phillip Association and the local Aboriginal people, the Kulin people, in Melbourne in 1835. These treaties were controversial at the time and they've more or less proved controversial ever since. And there seems to be a range of really interesting questions you can ask about these treaties.
Before we do that, let's ask about Batman himself, because the view of him has certainly changed. You talk about a time when he was portrayed as rather heroically as a young bushman, but then there was a growing argument that he was a killer of Aboriginal people, although he perhaps might have had some sympathy for them.
Yes. Well, as you say, I think his reputation has changed enormously over the years, and particularly in recent times, I guess from the 1970s, or at least the 1980s onwards, he's increasingly been regarded as a murderer of Aboriginal people. I have a view of him that he is probably a murderer of Aboriginal people, indeed, undoubtedly so, but that he also felt some pangs of conscience about the role he'd played in the Black War in Tasmania, and along with the other members of the Port Phillip Association who do this treaty, they have some humanitarian sense, I would argue. They're primarily land grabbers, that's what they're wanting to do with the treaty, but I think there's also a sense that they are troubled by what has happened and what they've been involved in Tasmania in the 1820s.
So the guy who died, described as a whoring boozer and a syphilitic, has got some, we've got to take him very seriously. Tim Flannery says that Batman, had he taken a more enlightened approach to Aboriginal people than his contemporaries, but he casts the treaty as the beginning of a bloody process of dispossession. What thinkest thou?
Well, I think what the Port Phillip Association was trying to do with the treaty was actually begin possession peacefully. And I think if you look at what influenced them, that reinforces that view. I argue in the book that one of the things they have very much in mind is this mythic tale about the treaty that William Penn does in the 17th century in, of course, Pennsylvania. It's a very powerful story, a humanitarian story, if you like, that circulates throughout the 18th and into the early 19th century. And it's interesting that when Batman returns from Port Phillip in 1835, having done, he says, this treaty, that one of the Tasmanian newspapers greets him as the Tasmanian Pen. And so I think that in their treaty making, they are very much reacting to what has happened in Tasmania. I think it's significant that a group of Tasmanian settlers think about doing a treaty, whereas New South Wales settlers had not thought of doing one. And I think they do that because they realise that the Black War has exacted a very high cost, a high cost on Aboriginal people, but a very high cost for settlers. And they hope that by doing a treaty in Port Phillip, that they will start a process of possession on much more peaceful terms. That's their hope, that's their aspiration, I believe.
Batman's approach to treaty making involved exchanging land for blankets, knives, looking glasses, tomahawks. Was it considered by anyone to be a fair exchange in its era?
Well, I guess what we must remember is that as well as those goods, there was supposed to be an annual tribute. They were supposed to pay the rent every year. And I guess what's important here, at least from an Aboriginal point of view, is that once they grasped what the treaty was, at the very least, it was recognition that they were the owners of the land, and it tried to establish a relationship with them. And so certainly further down the track, certainly in the 1930s, we know that Aboriginal people in Melbourne and elsewhere in Victoria looked upon Batman as a good man because he at least had recognised that they were the owners of the land.
Yeah.
But certainly others were very sceptical of this. But I guess what we have to realise, and this goes back to your opening comments, is that no treaties were done in Australia. And so between 1788 and 1835, when this treaty was done, the settlers had proceeded as though there were no Aboriginal owners of the land whatsoever. And so, of course, other settlers were very hostile to this treaty making, and the government was just as antagonistic to it.
Is that why the colonial authorities effectively tore it up?
Yes, I think they were very concerned that it drew attention to the fact that they had proceeded on the basis that there was no such thing as Aboriginal or native title. And the colonial office in London certainly says that if the treaty had been recognised by government, it would have undermined completely the title that whites had assumed they had to the land, and it would have undermined the legitimacy, if you like, of the entire colonial project up until that point.
My guest is Brian Attwood. Brian's Professor of Historical Studies at Monash, Adjunct Professor of the Centre for Cross-Cultural Research at the ANU, and the book I hold in my left hand is Possession, Batman's Treaty, and the matter of history. Now, Bain, the British entered into treaties with the indigenous people of their other colonies, North America, Southern Africa, New Zealand. Why not recognise Aboriginal sovereignty here?
Well, I think there's a number of ways of understanding this. I think, first of all, we need to recognise that they were influenced by a set of ideas, and those set of ideas tended to say that where an indigenous people did not seem to have what was required for their sovereignty to be recognised, that their property rights were denied in turn. And they often believed that so-called nomadic people had not reached a stage of civilization whereby they had earned property rights. So I think there is that set of ideas at work, but what's striking, of course, is that North America, Southern Africa, New Zealand, the Australian colonies, they're all founded by the British, and yet the British practice varies from one place to the other.
Mm.
And you would think if they were influenced by a common set of ideas, they would have done the same in each place. Now, it seems to me that what happens in Australia, which is different from those other places, depends very much on what happened in the early years of settlement. Now, if you take North America and New Zealand, I think it's clear that when whites first colonised those places, they were in very small numbers, they were vulnerable, and if they wanted access to land, they had to negotiate with the indigenous people, and that meant forming agreements, in effect, making treaties. But in Australia, unlike those places, of course, because it's a convict colony, right from the beginning, the state is there, and when Governor Phillip, the first governor, comes, he brings a military force of at least 200 Marines. Now, that's not an inconsiderable military force. And so I think what happens in New South Wales, even though Governor Phillip is quite apprehensive at the start about what the military capacity of Aboriginal people will be, within at least 18 months, if not earlier, he's become convinced that Aboriginal people do not pose a major threat. That may be because they've been undermined by the smallpox epidemic. But he concludes that the British can simply take the land. And so they just start taking the land, and there's never a recognition of Indigenous sovereignty. So I think what happens on the ground in terms of what we might call simply power and force is very important to whether the British do treaties in one place but not in another. And so what I'm saying here, I guess, is what happens in those early years of settlement are absolutely crucial. And I often wonder what would have happened if New South Wales had not begun as a convict colony. What had happened if whalers and sealers and missionaries, say, had been there first of all?
Because let's test this. Was there any difference in South Australia?
Well, I think the problem here is that once colonisation has started in one place, it's very hard to shift the direction.
Even now, in a state like South Australia, which was not a prison camp?
Well, yes, I think so. I think so because by this stage, certain habits of thought have been created, and I think most importantly, certain expectations have been created. And so at the point in the 1830s where the Colonial Office does arguably try to exert some influence on the South Australian Colonisation Commission in reference to native title for Aboriginal people, the commissioners simply turn around and say, how can you treat us differently to how you've been treating settlers previously?
Yeah.
We simply will not accept this. And they just go ahead, and even though they make promises that they will recognise Aboriginal title if they find there's evidence of that, they actually never believe that there's any such thing as Aboriginal title, and they never recognise it.
Bain, at the beginning of your book, you quote Sir William Blackstone from the Commentaries on the Laws of England back in 1823, and I'm going to quote him as well. Pleased as we are with the possession, we seem afraid to look back to the means by which it was acquired, as if fearful of some defect in our title, or at best we rest satisfied with the decisions of the laws in our favour, without examining the reason or authority upon which those laws have been built. It took Eddie Mabo in the High Court a long time to address that issue.
Yes, that's right. But what I argue in the book, and it's the reason why I've called it possession, is that I think there's ways in which the settler society comes to be possessed by its doubts about the legitimacy.
Possession, the title has multiple meanings.
Indeed, indeed. And so what I try to trace in the second part of the book is the creation of what I call two settler legends, one a legend around the figure of Batman himself, and the other around Batman's treaty. And what I'm trying to show is the way in which there continues to be considerable apprehension about the moral basis of white possession of the land. And I think that even though that was often a kind of underground apprehension, there are various points where this clearly emerges. And I think the role of story and the role of history is very important here, that the white settlers are trying to tell stories, are trying to create histories in order to legitimate the possession of the land. And this is one of the reasons why Batman's Treaty was never forgotten, that some humanitarians, like the historian James Bonwick, he was conscious that the British had made treaties everywhere else and not here. He had a great knowledge of the war in Van Diemen's Land and then what happens in Victoria. And he's drawn to a figure like Batman. He mythologizes Batman as this great humanitarian figure. So
it's interesting the way you deal with the parallel legends of Batman, and it reminds me that on our classic program last Friday, we replayed a chat I had with Eric Hobsbawm, in which he has a term that you refer to as the invention of tradition, and you document this very vividly.
Yes, one of the things I try and do in the book is show the importance of history making not only in a literary fashion, not only in the form of words, but in the form of the visual images. And as Batman is created as this founding figure, not surprisingly, there becomes a need to know what he looks like. And as far as we know, there's no image of Batman created in his lifetime, no portrait, no likeness.
So that image that I have in my mind is posthumous.
Very much so. It's an invented tradition. And so what I try and trace in the book is the way this picture comes into being, how it's created by particular artists, and then it just comes...
Well, you actually name the artist. You find the authors of this tradition.
Yes, and I think what's interesting here, to refer back to the legend of William Penn's treaty, is that the painter who first invents an image of John Batman, is actually influenced by a very famous Benjamin West painting of Penn's Treaty in Pennsylvania, Benjamin West being an American artist who later moves to London and becomes very famous as a history painting. And so what we can trace here is a series of traditions which you know, circulate around the world and which get taken from, if you like, from North America to Australia. Mm. And they continue, and I think the power of convention is very important here. Once a group of people have an image in their mind, that image is just repeated time and time again. And so even
and
today,
you fiddle with it at your peril.
Well, indeed, indeed.
Okay, I dimly remember, but I do recall it, a protest march led by Doug Nicholls, who, of course, went on to become Australia's first Aboriginal governor, state governor, during the Dunstan years. And he was the leader of the Victorian Aborigines Advancement League. And he leads a protest march, which begins at the Batman Memorial on Flinders Street. So clearly, the Batman Treaty holds symbolic value for the Aboriginal land rights movement.
Yes, this is right. I mean, I think increasingly from the 1960s onwards, Aboriginal people in Victoria are looking for ways to promote the cause of what by then has been called the movement for land rights. And they're saying, well, look, right at the start, this important foundational figure, John Batman, recognised that we were the owners of the land. Why aren't you doing this? And so, as you're saying, 1963, at the time when they're protesting against the loss of a reserve at Lake Tyres in Victoria, they start their protest march heading towards Parliament, but they start down at this memorial on Flinders Street in Melbourne. And so they're very much keeping alive the tradition.
As did the image of Gough Whitlam pouring earth into the hands of Vincent Lingiari in 1975.
Yes, yes, which has become a very famous photograph, hasn't it? And that's an interesting story. I mean, as I guess many of your listeners will know, it's often thought that one of the key moments in the modern land rights movement is the Gurindji people's walk-off at Wave Hill in 1966, the story that Frank Hardy told so well, and that in 1975, the Whitlam government grants a lease to the Gurindji people at Wave Hill, and as you're saying, he pours the sand into the hands of Vincent Lingiari. Now, why does that happen? Well, Whitlam
well,
is
it happened because
advice.
Nugget Coombs suggested
it. Nugget Coombs gives him this advice, and this refers back to what happened in 1835 in Batman's Treaty, because at that time he's using a form of legal conveyancing, which is known as enfeoffment, and part of the requirement of that means of conveyancing was that the seller of the land, in the case of Batman's Treaty, or the so-called sellers of the land, the Aboriginal people, gave a symbol of the land to the buyer. It could be a twig, it could be a branch, it could be a lump of soil. And what Nugget Coombs tells Whitlam, he tells him this story and suggests that it was time to reverse the process and that this was to mark the beginning of restitution. Now, Nugget Coombs knew the story from the anthropologist Bill Stanner.
Yeah.
So Stanner, you know, he's very much troubled, of course, by the course of the 1960s and into the 1970s, that Aboriginal title hasn't been recognised. He plays a very important role in the Yolngu's people's case in the Gove decision in 1971, which fails, and that then, I suppose, eventually inspires the Mabo case that you were talking about at the start.
Yeah. These moments, pouring a bit of dust into someone's hand, and it become so overwhelmingly significant. Now, Bain, Tom Carmer delivered the Mabo, Eddie Mabo lecture last week and said that the end result of the native title system we have in place today is said by some to have simply formalised dispossession. What do you reckon?
Well, I'm afraid that's right. I think while there have been some gains under native title, one might say the most spectacular gain is that eventually under the amended Native Title Act, or actually in the first Native Title Act, it meant that huge amounts of leasehold land actually became freehold title of whites, not Aboriginal people. And I think one might look back in retrospect and actually wonder whether trying to advance the cause of land rights for Aboriginal people through the courts was the most advantageous way to proceed? What would have happened if there'd been an ongoing attempt to work politically? After all, the most important land rights legislation in Australia was the 1976 Land Rights Act, in other words, way before trying to proceed through the courts with native title.
We've got to wrap it, Bain. Pleasure doing business with Bain Attwood, Professor of Historical Studies at Monash and an author. His latest effort is Possession. We now find that's got an interesting ambiguity about it. Possession, Batman's Treaty and the Matter of History, and it's published by a publisher I can't pronounce. On our next, we'll be looking more closely at the situation in North Korea, the two American journos kidnapped, as mentioned by Bruce Shapiro tonight, refugees flooding into China, and those nuclear tests. Oh, and we'll find out the secret to happiness. Heavens above, are we going to do this? Or at least the results of a very long study on happiness conducted through happiness experts, happiness authorities, academic happiness experts at Harvard. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news, and I'd be very happy if we could see you later.